begin on page 54 this morning. Hinduism. Admittedly, those who would look at it from the outside say it's very complex. It has many different roads. It's almost unintelligible. But it is a religion that billions of people adhere to, especially in India and Nepal. India just surpassed this last month China in population. 1.4 billion people in India. And it's a faith and religion that's really been in written form in India around 500 BC. It says it's got its roots in 1500 BC. And of course, at 500 and forward there, that's that time where we had, you know, the blooming of written materials. And so they started their writing in that time. Hinduism, with its many, many facets, can almost accommodate any religion. It has millions of gods, deities. It has deities for just anything, any emotion you have, anything physical you can think about. You know, if you have a deity for rain, you have a god for dryness. You have a god for clouds. You have a god for no clouds. It's millions of gods. And so that's been developing over all this time. And as we'll see, their more set scriptures, quote unquote, are called Vedas. And we'll get into that. I'll read some of those and get some dimensions on those. But that's an evolving thing. And they teach, okay, a lot of things that are really hard to understand for the Western mind, really for their minds too. It's so complicated that really from multiple sources, that even in the minds in India, the common man, they really don't understand it either. They just go along and do the festivals. They do what mechanically they're told to do by the gurus, by their teachers. And again, when you talk about Hinduism, it's every part of your life. Thoughts, manners, physical, metaphysical, on and on and on. And we've talked about millions of gods. I mean, for anything, okay? And you can imagine how many emotions you have. You can list those. And even that pretends that you may have one god against another in their views from time to time. And again, these gods they have are written down, quote unquote, by those who have been inspired. And it's many, many of these gods. You know, a Hindu is told that if you wake up at 3 a.m. in the morning, which I think some of us do, I tend to more and more, that's God telling you to go in there and pray so you can do a righteous thing. And contemplate your day and what you're going to do and what you're not going to do. And look at all the Vedas, which encompasses everything in one's life. They're quote-unquote scriptures. So it's it's hard to imagine, you know, one, you can in touch with oneself, okay? You can become one with the universe. I mean, it goes on and on. And again, all these are mystical gods. And in India, especially India, Hinduism is associated with family. It's associated with a culture, the long culture of the country. It's associated with the art. Art's pretty special that they have. They've got a picture for almost every god. The way they dress, eating habits. And we know about the sacred cow. I guess we've always heard that in reincarnation. But there's many reincarnations involved. And that's associated with karma. So it's a difficult thing to understand. And the hem of the garment is just the hem of the garment. But in reference to that, we may say they're polytheistic, many gods. We may say they're panistic, okay, because God is within you and within all living things, which is what they say. This wood, the lights, yourself, trees, rocks, earth, air, all gods for all of it. That's where you get the millions of gods. So, but there's a sincerity in that, and that's what you do when you're in a Hindu culture. Does it make you aware of your existence? Yes. That's why you're always trying to increase your karma, quote unquote, and trying to get on the plus side of good deeds, or bad, good thoughts, good actions, and not to get on the bad side of that. So there's a lot to Hinduism. All these gods they have, we'll get to it in just a second, but there's one supreme being, God, okay, that they look at, and that's Brahman and Brahma. And we'll get to that in just a second. But I want you to know that your God is a personal God. And he says, I save you. I did this for you. You don't have that in Hinduism. You don't say, I want you to improve. I want your belief to be in me. It's not there. So it's kind of a nebulous thing in Hinduism. So I wanted to say that to start with, and I'll say some verses on that. Yeah, that's my second thing about being personal, is your God is knowable. He's exposed himself to you. Your God says, I love you. That's an emotion. Your God says, I want to take care of you. Your God says, I have a place for you for all eternity. Hinduism, their final place is nothing. No issues. No problems. No heaven. So you've got a personal God that is knowable, and he's exposed himself to you through the actions from creation on, through Abraham, Moses, through the prophets, through Jesus the Christ. Your God has said, I care. Personally, I care about not you as a group, but you as an individual. And consequently for that, judge individually too. So that's a big difference there. We all want to be associated with someone that cares, and versus some nebulous thing. Now, I was in the Old Testament in Deuteronomy 6. Is a God knowable? How is he knowable? Back to Linda's point. In Deuteronomy 6:1, now this is the commandment, the statutes, and the judgments which the Lord your God has commanded me to teach you. Commanded me to teach you. He's knowable, teaching you things. The Lord God did that. So that you may do them in a land where you are going over to take possession of it. So that you, your son, and your grandson will fear the Lord your God to keep all of his statutes and his commandments, which I command you, all the days of your life. And that your days may be prolonged. Personal. I care about your life. I care about what you do each day. I want you to think about what I desire for those days and those hours, but I still care. And I want you to be saved, and you see my love and you care for that. And now, Israel, you shall listen and be careful and do them so that it may go well with you and that you may increase greatly, just as the Lord, the God of fathers, has promised you, in a land flowing with milk and honey. And to continue in that, just in verse 4, Deuteronomy 6, 4, hear Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. And you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength. These words. Knowable, caring, personal. Cares for you. Cares for all his creation. And that's a strong point to know, that we have that association directly. When you pray, you don't pray to, well, what's God today? All right? Pray to one God, don't you? Okay? And that's assurance that you have that direct contact. In the past, there's been some quote-unquote Christian religions, okay, and even today, that you need to go through an intercessor, you know, for your prayers to be heard, your requests to be heard. But your God had direct contact with you, and that's very good, very personal. Now, in 1 Corinthians 8, 4, I've got some, and also your God is a jealous God coming up. He brings you the land that your fathers, for Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, swore to him. He keeps his promises. Personal God, okay? Not just one who demands things. One's personal. I care. And in 1 Corinthians 8, 4, therefore, concerning the eating of food sacrificed to idols, we know that an idol is nothing at all in the world, and that there is no God but one. No God but one. And that deity is going to give us strength, give us confidence, that we're not confused, there's no contradictions in what one wants and another wants. You don't have these gurus in between saying this or that that oppose what one other God says. And as we can see, and I was doing the dates a while ago, you know, really it started to be written around 500 B.C. And a lot of things are happening at 500 to 0 B.C. And this is just one of those that I think sprang out of other religions, other faiths. And while I'm here, there is no person that started it, like we saw in Islam, Muhammad. It just got to, some guys got together and they got inspired. That's the way it writes. They said got inspired. And through the centuries, they got inspired. Okay. Through their, when they're meditation, thinking about life and trying to work worldly thoughts out of their mind, it came to them. They started writing it down. That's the origin of the Vedas, which is the scriptures they have. So it's kind of, is there a history? No, it's kind of origination of history, but you don't have the history that you have in scriptures. And like we did in section 4 of this class, you've got the historical, hard historical evidence that you can see from Moses' writings on through Christ and his apostles, that's verifiable instructions without contradictions. And that faith is verified by the resurrection and by those miracles ahead. So things to remember on that, okay? Let's see if I have... You know, you also have a God that created the heavens and the earth, where in Hinduism, creation there is really the individual gods authorized by Brahma. And, of course, in the beginning, God created heavens and the earth. And then Isaiah 40:28, do you know, have you heard, the Lord is the everlasting God, the creator of the ends of the earth. Creator. So be aware of that your God created everything, everything. He's not in everything, as we see in Hinduism. Like I mentioned, in living things and non-living things. So your God has created this for you. Another thing that's personal for you. And mankind's created in the image of God and lives only once. There's no reincarnation. And then in Hebrews 9:27, and just as it is destined for the people to die once, and after this comes judgment, also Christ also, having offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation. See, your God doesn't have you living a life. Whoops, I didn't make it. I didn't get the 51% good karma. So I got to live another life. Well, and this goes, some estimates mean, thousands of times. Who knows? Okay? And it's a never-ending doubt that you can have in your mind. Have I done enough? I thought I did enough. I followed everything. Didn't make it. And it's a thing that some people have tried to prove over the years, but they haven't. So your God judges one time. You have one go-around. And you here today, you're making a good go-around today. Have confidence in your faith and your actions. God knows that. It's written in the book of life, in your book of life. Now, we should always pray for others. And lastly, they have salvation in Jesus because of his resurrection. And you're only saved through Jesus. He's the only way to the Father. And I've got John 3:16, John 14:5, Acts 4:10. And that we can have proof in our mind and proof in scriptures, because the scriptures give us faith in the New Testament. Therefore, what's written in them gives us faith and confidence that he did rise on the third day, and they did ascend to heaven, that he cares now. So that's some confidence to build in your mind. Okay? Personal, knowledgeable, historical, and died once. And again, a sacrifice and a resurrection. So I just want to start with that before we go into these other things. Hinduism. It really started along the Indus River, Indus Valley, and they say 1500 B.C. And it's a 2,000-mile river, which really starts in northern India now and runs through Pakistan into the Gulf of. And as in all things, movements start in certain areas. And like, where did Judaism start? Tigris-Euphrates Valley over there, okay, Middle East. But this religion here started in India, in that northern part up in there. I knew a guy from Punjab. I worked with him, and that's the northern part of India. And he did his customs. He tried to talk with him, and I said, well, would you ever change if you're convinced that there's a truth greater than Hinduism? He said, no, I will not change. And again, that goes back to the idea that it's all wrapped into family, wrapped into the history of India. It's wrapped into the whole package of, I must say, nationalism, patriotism. And to deny Hinduism is to deny the whole heritage that you saw, to deny everything about the country, about your ancestors. That's hard. That's hard. I know some of you have been to that point in your life where I've just got to leave a religion that I was in before, a form of Christianity, I guess. And it's difficult, especially when the family says it's hard. I can meet them in occasions and weddings and funerals and Thanksgiving and others like that. So, but this is much deeper than that. Okay? All right. Now, in Hinduism, there's a lot of definitions that sound strange. And they are to us. Again, to them, I don't think they really understand it either. Because when you look into their interpreters of the Vedas, they come up with different evolving conclusions and commentaries. And even though they're Hindi, they They say, well, yeah, well, the meats, we can change meats and that. We can go for chicken. Stay away from the beef, but you can have some chicken. Where the older commentators say, no, none of that. Eggs are no egg. It goes on and on and on, okay? So that's why you see India's mainly a vegetarian country. Of course, there's cracks in that. I know when the British were there, there was a lot of influence there for meats and also the introduction of quote-unquote Christianity. So a lot of conflict in that very, very large country, in that region. And consequently, you would say, oh, they've got a lot of idols. Yeah, they got a lot of idols. That's why in the past there have been wars with, what did we study last class? Islam. And Islam does not tolerate idols. You can't even have a picture. You can't even draw a picture of Muhammad. That's an idol. So there's wars in the past because, you know, they got shared borders. And, of course, when you get to a billion and a half people, that kind of slows down the wars a little bit against, you know, the Middle East. But they're still struggling with that. And this man I talked to you about, he had those battles up in that northern part of India, in the Punjab area. And it was on their minds. But he reasoned that it strengthened their faith in Hinduism. Okay, because somebody's warring against you to change you. So it's interesting. Okay? In definitions, you'll find them vague, maybe not logical. Again, most of the world finds them that way too. But it's still a belief system because you go to the festivals, you're buried a certain way, you marry a certain way. You pray from dusk till dark, okay, and beyond. Who you marry, I'll go get in the caste. I hope you read that about the caste system in your material. That's a hard iron that's still there in that area. In Hinduism, a Brahman connotes the highest universal principle, the ultimate reality of the universe. Well, what is the ultimate reality of the universe? And in major schools of Hindu philosophy, is the material, efficient, formal, and final cause of all that exists. The final cause. It is the pervasive, infinite, eternal truth, consciousness, and bliss, which does not change, yet it is the cause of all changes. Brahman, as a metaphysical concept, refers to the single binding unity behind diversity and all that exists in the universe. What did I just say? It's hard. All right? I think a lot of it just confuse people. And Brahman is in Hindu philosophy, is a supreme Brahma, that which is beyond all descriptions and conceptions. It is described as a formless and eternal, pervades everything, everywhere in the universe, and was beyond and exists as a Trimura. I'll do a Trimura in a minute. So it's in everything. This force, this essence, okay, is in all living and non-living things. It's in the planets and the stars you see. It's in the air that you breathe. It's in everything. Pervades everything. So you can't get away from us, what I'm getting. And therefore, you've got millions of gods, millions of people to pray to think about. And it's a... And then it manifests itself in the Trimura. Tri is what? T-R-I. What's that mean? Three. I see it as a parallel to the Trinity. And again, the Trimura is three forms of the Trinity, or the Trinity of Supreme Divinity in Hinduism, in which the cosmic functions of creation, preservation, destruction are personified in triune deities. And so even though you've got, you know, the Hinduism and the Brahman, he's divided into three pieces, okay? Three actions, I guess you'd say, and that's in your material. And confusing? Well, yes and no. I understand the Trinity, okay? But these actions are divided that way. And so the first one is Brahma, and is a Hindu god referred to as the creator within that Trinity of supreme divinity. He is associated with creation, knowledge, and the Vedas. The Vedas, the word Veda equals knowledge. The Brahma is prominently mentioned in creation legends. And he created himself in a golden embryo. Somehow created himself. So that's the Brahma. Understand that? Okay. Vishnu is the second one. Is known as the preserver. So he got the first one is the creator, and then now the preserver within this a triple deity. Vishnu is a supreme being who creates, protects, and transforms the universe. Okay, so you've got the universe out there and all around us, so he preserves it. So you've got a creator, and then created, and it preserves. And then sometimes in life, in planets, in your life, in structures that you know, whatever it is in the universe, the last one is the Shiva, is known as a destroyer within the Hindu Trinity. And Shiva is a primordial, unborn, original being. He is known as the one who is beyond anything and everything. He is the imperishable, unmanifested, ever-present consciousness. Well, you can, if you can define consciousness, go ahead. So that's all those thought processes that you can direct things to be done. I got a little talk on that about how the mind can control things. You know, I'll relate that to Star Wars. In Hinduism, there's another concept called Atman, A-T-M-A-N, and refers to the self-existent essence of human beings, the observing pure consciousness or witness consciousness. It is distinct from the ever-evolving embodied individual being. It's embedded in material reality and characterized by non-spiritual, psychological I-ness and me-ness. Me-ness and I-ness. I, me. And the mind and all the defiling habits, all things that defile. We're talking the destroyer. All things destroy your consciousness. Your association with Brahma. Our habits, prejudices, desires, impulses, delusions, fads, behaviors, pleasures, sufferings, fears. All those emotions are things that you need to deal with, and Brahma can help you with those. But, they're all embodied personally. They're shifts, they evolve, they change with time. While Atman doesn't, it is purely indifferent and self-shining consciousness. All right? So there's a lot of things that deal with the mind and the directions that the mind can use to influence your life and to also get in good with Brahma. That's why you need 1 million gods, 2 million gods, 5 million gods. And it includes consciousness, but also the mental abilities of a living being, such as reason, character, feeling, consciousness, memory, perception, and thinking. In Hinduism, these are all included in embodied reality, the counterpart of Atman. So again, there's Atman consciousness. So it's a lot of things mental, but it also manifests itself physically too. And one last thing on Atman. In Hinduism, it's considered as eternal, imperishable, beyond time. Quote, not the same as body or mind or consciousness, but something beyond, which permeates all things. Atman is the unchanging, eternal, innermost, radiant self that is unaffected by personality, unaffected by ego. Atman is that which is ever free, never bound, and realized purpose, meaning, liberation, and life. The ultimate goal of Hindu religious life is to transcend the individual, to realize one's own true nature, the inner essence of oneself, which is divine and pure. So shed this mortal thing. Shed these actions. Do what's good. And again, that's where karma comes in. And when you've done all this, if you've attained through reincarnation, if you attain that selfless, that knowing self, immerse yourself in Brahma, then that's called Moksha. And you've got that in your material. M-O-S-H-A. M-O-K-S-H-A. And is a term for various forms of emancipation, enlightenment, liberation, and release. It refers to freedom from the cycle of death and rebirth. Moksha is freedom from ignorance, self-realization, self-actualization, and self-knowledge. In Hindu traditions, moksha is a central concept and the utmost aim of human life. And the other three aims being, I'll get them in just a moment. So, when you finally get your karma right, when you finally get things that are on the good side, when you finally adhere to the Vedas, when you finally please Brahma, then you can expect to be liberated. And the relation that they have is like a candle. Your life is a candle that's lit. And when you finally reach, okay, the ultimate, okay, moksha, then it goes out. You're emancipated. And then you go into non-existence. Non-existence. Okay? No reward. No heaven. Just no more turmoil. No more trying to do what's doing the right things to please Brahman. And it's a interesting concept, okay, if you can reach that point. But most people don't believe they can reach that point. And they keep recycling over and over and over as higher beings or lower beings, okay? And we talk about cattle, dogs can turn into a person. I mean, it goes on and on. And you can carry that bad karma with you to the next life, the next manifestation. So it's a hard concept for this reincarnation that they have. And karma, let me talk about that a minute. Karma is a concept of Hinduism which describes a system in which beneficial effects are derived from past beneficial actions and harmful effects from past harmful actions, creating a system of actions and reactions throughout a soul's reincarnated lives, forming a cycle of rebirth that applies not only to the material world, but also to our thoughts, words, actions, actions of others. You cause others to do certain things that fits in your karma. If you cause other people to do good things, that's good karma for you. But if you do things that hinder other people, you do things that cheat other people, okay, that goes against your karma. That's bad. So that everything is just a balance. And if I may say here, karma is non-sympathetic, non-sympathizing, non-loving. It's just right down the road, okay? You may, because it knows your thoughts, knows your intentions, it knows everything. And your karma can be balanced one way or another. No leeway. Adhere to the Vedas or not. And as your God has compassion. Your God understands everything that you do and what you think. Yes, that's true. But your God also has that great, great grace extended to you. Because your sins are not forgiven by you, no matter what you do. They're not balanced out. That's why you need a sacrifice. That's why, from the beginning, the sacrifice was predicted, prophesied, and accomplished through Jesus of Nazareth. One time for all time. So you have to keep worrying about that. You do the best you can. You know what's right. Keep studying. Keep looking. And keep associating with those who believe. Now, and the last part. There's a doctrine of transmigration associated with karma. Transmigration is what? You migrate from one being, whoop, bad karma. Okay? You migrate into another being in birth. Reborn. and whatever you're reborn into, and you get another chance at life. So it's on and on and on. And that's called transmigration of the soul. And again, it deals with the acts. And there's a in the Vedas, there's really four Vedas. And in Rig Veda, Mandala 1, Sukha 24, Mantra 2, with words like, I'm going to translate it, you must also know that one God, to be giver of rebirth, none else can do this work. It is He who gives birth to emancipated persons, also through parents at the end. Rebirth is also mentioned in Rig Veda, Mandala 10, circa 56. And it's that human beings are said to produce karma in four ways. And it's your thoughts produce karma one way or another. If you have the right attitude words, say good things, okay, or bad things, or imply certain things. Those are registered against your karma. And actions that we perform ourselves, again, things we do ourselves, it's obvious. And then the last one is the idea of how we influence others. And our karma reflects, okay, into what we influence others. So, karma. And the last one is the Vedas, which I mentioned. The Vedas, again, are the equals knowledge. It's a large body of religious texts originating in ancient India. The texts constitute the oldest scriptures of Hinduism. There's four or five Vedas. And the Rig Veda is one. Yajura Veda, the Sarna Veda, and the Altar Veda. Each Veda has four divisions. One of them is mantras and benedictions. So these four are divided into four mantras and benedictions. One is rituals. The next one is rituals, ceremonies, sacrifice, and symbolic sacrifices. And the next one is commentaries on the rituals. So you've got the rituals, but then you need a commentary on it. To how to perform it, how to do it, what not to do with it. And the next one is a text discussion, meditation, philosophy, spiritual knowledge, another Veda. And another is worship. How do you worship? So they've got their instructions. They've got their books. They've got their writings. And again, the gurus teach these. And in the beginning, again, it was all oral. Then they tried to put it down. And even today, they have a lot of heavy classes, okay, on how to perform these rituals. Now, Hindus consider the Vedas to be not of a man, superhuman, and impersonal authorities, revelations of sacred sounds and texts heard by ancient sages after intense meditation, which I mentioned that. And so all this came to be, their holy book, I guess you'd say, holy writings. And what can I say? They've taken a page out of the Bible, and I think that's where a lot of that came from. But you've got to write things down for people. Now, I was going to read some of the Vedas, but I'll let that go. But I want to say one quick thing about Star Wars. I mentioned it a while ago. If you look at Star Wars, that series, what stands out to you? The Force. That's right. Okay? That Force out there. What is it? Well, the Force can be used for what? Good and?
Evil.
Okay? So it's impersonal. So it's manifested in that movie. And the Force is the light side and the dark side manifest itself. So that's really a nice encapsulation, okay, of Hinduism. And we'll see somewhat Buddhism, Hinduism somewhat close, except Buddhism has Buddhas in their original writings, but Hinduism doesn't. And the Jedi teachers, teachers, okay? The gurus I've been talking about, that's the Jedi teachers. You look for good candidates, ones who have the inclination, who have the strong will inside of them to do the things that a Jedi would do. And of course, the other side of that. Now, and one last point, okay, is what else do they do with the force? They think, they know things are happening, but what else can they do with it?
They can move things.
Move things, all right? And
thoughts into other people.
And that's very much in Hindu perception. It's there. And Jedi masters have been depicted as exhibiting many superhuman powers, telekinesis, controlling and influencing others' minds, perceiving the past and future. And the movie again and again depicts the use of willpower. That's got a word, Ikka Shakti, in Hinduism. There is a large body of literature in Hinduism regarding superhuman powers and the means to obtain them. There's a Yoga Sutra, and Patanjali, for example, speaks about 8 major abilities that include telekinesis and controlling the minds of others. And also, there's a man that has, along with his power of action and power of knowledge, and have been given importance in Hinduism. So there's a lot of power involved, and they express that, okay? And so interesting Star Wars correlation there. And so that's that. Buddhism is similar. They kind of track together, so we'll do Buddhism on Wednesday. Thank you.